This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a full-service digital marketing web development firm that will help set you apart from your competition. Check them out at hypelegal.com. We're also brought to you today by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used by my firm and firms all over the United States to help manage their complex case and trial docket. Check them out, smartadvocate.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon. So Rahul, you just finished up a trial. I know the case settled before it went to verdict. So how did that work out for you?
It worked out okay. It was a good outcome, but I will say that, and I hate saying this, but I think the judge put the thumb on the scale a little bit to our disadvantage. We're going through jury selection, and I had a priest on my jury. This is just a perfect example of it. And he said he'd been sued for wrongful termination 25 years ago. And through that process, this janitor submitted a medical report. And he learned that if you pay a doctor any money, they'll say whatever you want. And that he didn't believe in these lawsuits and that he was still angry and wouldn't be fair. Your Honor, can we excuse this juror for cause? Judge says, he's a priest. He preaches forgiveness. He's got to practice what he preaches. So cause challenge denied. And then you could just imagine I had about 11 jurors like that. I got four cause challenges. And the questionnaires for the next batch looked really bad as well. And I could see what was going to happen. So we resolved the case for a lot, but not as much as I think I could have gotten.
That is one of the most maddening parts of what we do. It just, you know, when someone with the power of the robe gets in the way of just a fair fight, it makes you ill. But we've all lived with it over and over. Thank goodness most of the time we get a fair shake. But when you run into an unfair one, it makes you want to scream.
Well, we're really excited today to have Keith Mitnick on the podcast. That is the voice that you've just heard. Keith is the senior trial lawyer at Morgan & Morgan, which is the largest plaintiffs firm in the country. And in that role, it allows him to get into the courtroom probably more than any other human being on the planet, which is gives him a lot of insight into what works and what doesn't work. He's written two books, which I have read, which are available through Trial Guides. He also has his own podcast. So we're really excited to talk to Keith. We're also going to see you out in LA, I think, for the PSBR Trial College.
I just emailed my assistant saying, do not let me forget. I got to get a plane for the ride out. I have a trials around it. I'm trying to figure out when the heck I can get out there. But yes, I don't want to disappoint Panish. I'll be there.
No one does.
No.
So welcome, Keith. And I thought maybe we could start with, I've heard you speak a lot, and I know your mind is always working and developing kind of new approaches, troubleshooting things that haven't worked, improving things that have worked. Our listeners are on the very cutting edge. What are you working on right now?
I will tell you, that's interesting. I've always got something cooking in my head. I walk on the beach in the morning, and that's where my inspiration comes. I got a couple hot things. One that I haven't done anything with yet. I'm going to develop it, but I'll give it. This is as hot off the press as it gets. It came from this morning. I was thinking, just like you said with the jury selection, and in that case, we were talking about a judge, but we also know some jurors who clearly have a bias, will fight acknowledging it. We're never going to get rid of that problem. Some of it's ego, some of it's a lack of awareness. Some people want to get on to tank you. We all know that. But I've thought with the honest person, I'm always trying to think how to the path of least resistance to get people to say what needs to be said so you can establish a valid cause challenge on someone who ought not be deciding your case. And just a simple phrase that I thought of this morning that may help in talking to the jurors themselves is to say, when I give my analogy at the beginning about, you know, if there was a pie eating contest or barbecue, whatever it was, and I model for myself the right way, to add in after doing that, this phrase. Would all of you, anyone think that I was weak-minded? I always say this, I'll give you the new one in a minute, that I was weak-minded or unfair to acknowledge openly and honestly, I don't know I can base my decision solely on the evidence, and maybe the evidence plus these feelings. Would anyone think that? And they all say no. And I always say, does everyone think that's the right thing to do? And they'll say yes. Here's the little phrase that I think will help going forward with it, talking to them. What would you think about me having enough self-awareness to acknowledge that? I think saying self-awareness, then when I get going and someone models it correctly on the jury and says, yeah, honestly, I couldn't be completely fair and impartial. I do my best, but I couldn't. To add in, I appreciate your honesty and I appreciate your self-awareness. No one wants to be not self-aware. So I think when you get to that person who says, yeah, I've been sued and I'm still pissed off about it. And, you know, I hate lawyers and I hate bald-headed people and I hate everything about you, especially your fucking glasses. But I can be fair. Then you can say, but when you, before you ask the, can you, that ultimate question, say, and I appreciate, like the others, the fact that you seem to be someone who's self-aware. So let's talk about it. I think that may put people on the spot to not fight it so hard, because no one wants to come off like everyone's looking down at you like, buddy, you are unaware as hell. So anyhow, that was a hot off the presses. I haven't done anything with it. I'm probably going to give it a whirl next Tuesday when I pick a jury, see how it goes. The other thing, and I don't want to just go on from the first question, but I got another hot one that I just came up with and used in trial. And I'm in the process. My latest brushstroke, at home but not alone, written brushstroke, is going to be on this. I tried a case and we got a really good outcome. It was a herniated disc case and we got a $3.3 million verdict. You know, guy that with no wage loss claim, your tip surveillance, your typical everything these cases have, except we had the photos of the crash were relatively impressive. That was the only thing out of the ordinary. But I had a juror who I did not want on my jury, but I had to take the, you know, just the way it played out, it was going to get worse. So there were some things I liked, but I really didn't feel good about it. The lawyers I was helping with it wanted to take or not take the risk. I didn't. And I finally thought, you know, if I take it wrong and it gets worse, I'll hate myself. So I'll lay down and let them have their way. And I agreed with them ultimately. It was a smarter play. We get in about day three and here come in Florida, they get to, jurors can ask written questions. So we start getting some written questions out of her and they were terrible. And I went, God almighty, I knew it. You know, and we still got another 3 days of trial. I'm like, you know, you're wasting your time because she clearly was going to be a leader. So I'm just wanting to stab myself in the heart for not following my gut. But you still got to deal with it. And then she settled down and wasn't doing it anymore. And we got to closing argument. And I realized I always talk about framing your case. And you got to frame it to deal with what the defense is going to do. You got to frame it to best display your best facts. I realize there's something I'm going to call the final frame, which is once you know who your jurors are, you make tweaks for the particular jury. I've done that for years on the positive end. What came out of this is I had to deal with a real problem on my hands. I've done things in the past where I've done a thing called what I call where I had a bad juror who clearly everything I did hated me. I mean, I'd stand up and the guy go, you couldn't look at him or it sucked the energy out of you. And I did a thing on that case. That's a different case where I said in closing argument, I talked about there is strength in number and the American and in America, juries are so powerful because it isn't a one man decision or one woman decision. There's strength in number. That's what makes us Americans. That's what makes this system so good. Stay late, fight hard, stand up for what's right. And I isolated the guy. And it worked. He came out and had his head down. And I was afraid when they polled him, he was going to say, no, they didn't my verdict. But he mumbled yes. And we got a really good verdict. This lady I was going to do the same with. But I thought, you know what? There's some hope that she's not a lost cause. The other guy was lost. So I came up with something new I'm going to use over and over because we got a good verdict. We got a $3.3 million verdict on the thing, and she was the fourth person. It won't work with every juror who turns on you. You can tell by their questions or body language. But when you have the engineering type mind, a highly analytical person, this person was in analytics, And she was very proud that she was in analytics and told you she worked for a bank and was in analytics. And she talked a lot, and she was very analytic to the point she noticed a $200 screw up on her life care plan that didn't add up. She's sitting there with no calculator and figured it out. That's how analytical she was. So I did this. Here's the key phrase. Bias corrupts data. Bias corrupts data. So here's how I wove that concept. Because my idea was, she's very proud of her analytical mind. If I can set a situation, not by shaming her, but in a positive way, that if you start letting bias get in the way, you aren't analytical, you're emotional. You're not data-driven, you're emotional, which would this person would want nothing to do with that label. So it came out this way. I said, you know, we got a really smart jury. We got a former detective, was a professional in doing investigations. We got someone who's in analytics, and we got a lot of people who are smart, and I'm so glad we do, because any view of this evidence that's based on facts and evidence and data and analytics is for us. There's only one way the defense would win this case, and that's if bias came into play, because bias corrupts data. And I look right at her. And I said, bias corrupts data. And all of a sudden, instead of having a logical conclusion, you have an emotional conclusion. And I'm so glad we went through jury selection and went through the tedious process where you probably wanted to wring my neck, where I went on and on about feelings against lawsuits, feelings against pain and suffering, feelings against million-dollar verdicts. I said, and I know y'all probably wondered, gosh, how many times are you going to do it? But the fact we went through this together, we can all have peace of mind that bias won't corrupt data here. There were a lot of people on that panel that would have, but not a one of you, because every one of you passed that test and gave your word, and we know you meant it. So you care about justice. I care about justice. Together, we can rest assured there's no going to be corruption of data by bias here. It's going to be a fact-based decision. And then I went on into it, and my thought was, I think it may make her think, gosh. And if it didn't, it would arm others to say, lady, you're doing exactly what you said you wouldn't do. And damned if she didn't come out with a verdict, and we got a good verdict. Now, I think it might have been a little higher, but for her. But nonetheless, we were, you know, the other side was claiming it was one of these, give them 25 grand for the case was built on, you were only hurt for 3 months, and everything else after that's not got anything to do with the crash. And no pain, zero pain and suffering. So it was a good result. So anyhow, that was a long-winded start to that's hot off the presses.
I'm weaving that in. So wait, Keith, what's your, both of those are amazing. I learned the most in 13 minutes.
Oh, and let me just say one thing. That one I just did, the one, it doesn't have to be an analytics person. Your engineering mind, you know, anybody, we hear, see them all the time. Oh, I don't, won't bother me that I don't like this because I'm a facts, give me the facts. Well, we know that's not how bias works, and we want to eliminate them. But if you have someone on your jury that gets on that is of that kind of mindset, like an engineering type mind, I really think that is a good positive way to rein it in, if nothing else. Take the wind out of their sails.
So Keith, I love your apple pie, cherry pie analogy. I don't do apple and cherry pie because I love them both equally. But I do lemon cake and carrot cake because I really don't like lemon cake. But you just said at the very beginning, you said you've kind of tweaked it a little bit and modified your presentation on that. How did you do that?
Well, I can tell you the one is this. I'm going to add, I haven't done this one, that brand new one, where I'm going to add in the self-awareness comment. But here's the thing I've added to the cherry pie, apple pie, barbecue sauce. I tried one out in California. We did Merlot and Cabernets. And, you know, you can change it to wherever you are. It's just so long as it's something that you're not crazy about. The key is when you come up with one, don't be, I prefer, or I love, or I like, and don't be, I hate. I wouldn't do anchovies. Someone came to me and said, I do anchovies. I hate them. I said, I hate them too, but don't do it. It's too strong. You want it to be a subtlety. So I'm not crazy about cherry pie. Here's the add-in. It's working so well that I've had two judges now tell me that's the best explanation I've ever heard of how bias works. And I did it after a case in which I had a judge out of state up in Mississippi deny, I think it was 18 challenge for cause, every single one. And they were all locked down. I mean, he'd let me argue and argue, and he'd say, anything else? No, sir. And we ended up getting a really good verdict, significant seven-figure verdict, in spite of it. I'm still to this day stunned that we did. And here's what he did with every juror. You'll listen to the evidence and base your decision on the evidence of the law, right? Yeah, we've all heard it 100 times. And that once they said that to him, you're good. But I thought, you know what? I face that rehabilitation all the time. I need to add something to kill that. And I think I have. And this is it. Before I do the pies, I start with this. This is the new one. Little lead in, as I always say, we're going to be asking you questions about life experiences, beliefs, opinions that could potentially influence you if you sat on the case. Put one side, you know, a little behind, strike against, or the other side have a leg up, not on purpose. It's human nature. We all have subjects. If we were to sit in judgment of a debate or a disagreement, you'd come to it with some feelings where one side may start behind. That's just human nature. For example, and I would normally go from that right into the pies. I'm putting this step before it now. I say, for example, people think that trials are one big fight over the facts, a big conflict over what the evidence are, what the facts are. You'll be surprised to know that trials, for the most part, there are always some disputes over what the facts are or the evidence is, but most of it is not a dispute over facts or evidence. It's a dispute over conclusions from facts and evidence. And that's why I have to ask you these questions, because, and I use my hands like this, I say, because you're going to have a fact that everyone agrees on. And one side's going to be saying, we're going to be saying, here's the right conclusion. And I always put them lower. They're going to be saying, this is the right conclusion. And in this space between the fact and the conflicting conclusions being argued is where those life experiences, beliefs, or opinions can have an impact. People will say, facts are the facts. And I say, not so fast, because the facts are the beginning of the process, not the end. Let me give you an example. If it was a criminal case and the prosecutor was trying to convict someone of a crime, and in order to get the conviction, he knew the jury had to believe his star witness, and his star witness was a police officer. And there was one juror who tended not to believe anything police officers said. And there was another juror sitting right next to him who tended to believe everything police officers said. You can see how that witness could give the exact testimony in the exact trial at the exact moment, and those two different people, one of them would end up not guilty because they didn't believe him, and the other one would be guilty because they believed him, and the evidence didn't change at all. That's what I mean when I say it's not that simple. It's the evidence plus reality. I call it the evidence plus reality. It's evidence plus life experiences, beliefs, and opinions that then will impact, not unfairly, but human nature-wise, is going to impact with certain folks the conclusion. That's why we go through this process. If I can give you one more example that has nothing to do with the law, because I think it's helpful when we go through this process, if you understand why I'm asking. I think it's out of respect to you, and I also think it makes the process work better if you understand what I'm getting at. If we were having a competition to see who had the best pies, then I roll into the pies. Then at the tail end, when I finish that, I come back to the evidence plus model. If I were to say to the contestants, I cannot assure you that I can put that aside. I can't assure you my decision can be based solely on the evidence being the pie. Certainly it's going to be the pie, but I can't rule out it's going to be the evidence plus. I'm not crazy about cherry pie. I can't turn it on and off like a light switch. If I said that honestly, I'll do my best to base it on that evidence, but my best honest answer is it's probably going to be the evidence plus. I ain't crazy about cherry pies, or it certainly could happen. Would anyone think that made me weak-minded? Would anyone think that made me an unfair person? No. Would everyone think that was the only right thing to do? Yes. And then I'm going to add in now, and by the way, would people think I respect the fact that you were self-aware enough in taking this process seriously to be honest enough to say that? Would you applaud my self-awareness? See that little self-awareness thing? I think you're watching me evolve it right live. I just added that last little piece to it. Talk to me in about a week. I'm going to do that on Tuesday. But that's the new piece. And what it did to me, it's a realization that goes beyond just the jury selection. It's funny. We all try cases, and I never thought about the fact it's not really a fight over facts. It's a fight over conclusions. I designed it for the voir dire issue. Oh, let me finish that. And I want to tell you that added benefit. I'm realizing this thing's a gift that keeps giving. Now, when I'm in with the jurors and someone says, these feelings may impact me, and you'd be starting out behind. And I say, so would the truth be, your decision may not be based solely on the evidence. It may be the evidence plus reality plus these feelings impacting the ultimate conclusion. Yes. I got them all to say that. And right before I sit down, when I loop back to galvanize my cause challenges, I go back through the scenario. Was there any confusion? I read their names out. I appreciate your candor. Was there any confusion? Anybody want to change your answer? I'm about to sit down. I won't get to talk to you anymore. So now would be the time. No one ever changes their answer. And I say, this is a process of mutual respect, in the mutual respect meaning you showed respect to the process by just telling it like it is, each of you on the list. And we appreciate it. I appreciate all of you, but particularly those of you that were open and honest about these feelings that would impact you. I say mutual respect because we then show respect back to you by no one's going to try to twist your arm or make you change your honest answer on that topic. Before I sit down, I just want to be sure. If anyone were to ask y'all, can you base your decision on the evidence and follow the law? I understand. I want to make sure I'm clear. Your answer would be, sure, I'll base it on the evidence, but it'd be the evidence plus those feelings coming into play. Is that what your response would be? Yeah. I'm telling you, I've had back lawyers that do it all the time, won't even ask them because they're looking like they're asking them to change. It's so obvious. Now, people will still change it. It's baffling to me. But when it comes time to argue your cause challenge and you've got them to say evidence plus, and they'll start using it. The jurors will say to the defense lawyer, yeah, of course I'm going to listen to evidence, but it's like this other gentleman said, you know, and someone else go, evidence plus. And it just sticks. It's catchy, and it really, really works well. Now, last thing. Here's the added benefit of this epiphany that trials aren't a big fight over facts so much as it is a fight over conclusions from facts, is it fits into how you look at your case. You look at your case and you go, you know what? What is the conclusion they're after and I'm after? What are the fixed facts? And how do I, in that same space, point the jurors in the right direction to reach the right conclusion? And it is a mindset that gets you quicker to the problem solving that has to be done in dealing with the defense's favorite facts. And it even works in cross-examining their experts. Think about this. You don't want to do it too early because your expert's the same. But when their expert comes, you can have them on the stand and say, now, sir, you weren't there for any of this, were you? No. So you're not providing facts. You're just giving what you say or your conclusions from facts. And all of a sudden, jurors go, yeah, this guy's just spouting his friggin' opinions off. He's just giving his conclusions. And by the way, in closing, I say, he was just giving his conclusions from the facts. He couldn't have sat on this jury. He's being paid by that side. And so he's going to tell you what your conclusion ought to be. But if you do that, you got to add in. Now, of course, the expert we bought, we got the same problem in all honesty. The difference is y'all are sitting over here using your common sense and one of them adds up and one of them doesn't hold water. And then you're okay.
Do you actually say the expert you bought?
No, I wouldn't. Did I say? I said brought. I said expert we brought.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't say we bought. And as a matter of fact, I will never say we brought again. It sounds too much like bought.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Here's a question for you about your process. I know you guys have Morgan & Morgan does cases all over the country, and in some jurisdictions, like Maine, where I practice, and I know New Jersey, and just lesser extent Massachusetts, although that's changing, but a whole variety across the country, there isn't even an opportunity to do voir dire at all. What do you do if you're in a jurisdiction where you can't do that?
I cry a little because I know the chances of winning go way down and chances of getting a really big time fair verdict goes way down. So, because I go places where it isn't. I try not, but I do. And I get in federal court where most of them don't let you. So number one, any of these services, or if you have someone who's good at it in your office, can do the background searches are essential because you got at least, because the judge in those cases probably usually doesn't find a lot out about them. So I want to know everything I can find out about them. So I at least have a better, even though I can't get people for cause, I can at least have the wisest possible use of my peremptories. And you factor in heavily, don't ever forget the question of leaders. If someone is bad, but they're not going to give a damn and not really going to say much and they just want to get out of there, they don't scare me. But someone who's not as bad, but is a power broker and it is bad, that's the person got to go. So you got to have some kind of ranking system. You gather what you can, you listen closely, you watch their body language, you know, everything about them. And I would assign different people at my table to watch different parts of the jury because you pick up a lot of cues when there's no voir dire and all you're doing is watching, just when the judge describes what the case is. When he says this is a case involving a car crash and personal injuries, you can see someone go, you got to be really tuned in from every sense and source that you can gather information so you can then prioritize your peremptories. And then secondly, I always am a maniac about framing away the defense's favorite facts. And you can. The perspective, it's amazing to me how you can change how someone looks at a fact and it goes from a bad fact to a good fact. And it usually starts with something like, to make matters worse. You know, I had one where someone called me with our own firm and they were very concerned because they had a professional roofer and they're supposed to, on the vents, there was something about a vent needed to be marked. And they put a tag on this thing because it could be a tripping hazard. And their whole argument was, and the suit was over, it wasn't tagged. And their argument was, he's a professional roofer, for God's sake, what's he tripping over it for? We flip that to, or going to, the case ain't gone to trial yet. And to make matters worse, he's a professional and he knows the rules that they have to be tagged. Someone who didn't get up on roofs is tiptoeing around scared to death and everything on the roof looks like it's gonna kill him. But a professional's up there moving around like the rest of us would on a sidewalk because he doesn't worry about those because he knows the tag's supposed to be there. So this wouldn't be much of a case to somebody that wasn't a roofer, but this guy's a roofer. Now, all of a sudden, what's the defense going to do when they get up and say, well, he's a roofer? You look over and say, told you so. That's an example of what I call taking a fact that they may win on and figuring out how to present that fact so the right conclusion gets reached, not the wrong. So you're in that space between facts and conclusions, and you spend time thinking about it to where you get it to where that fact's good for you. If possible, at the very least, it's not scary anymore, not as scary. So if I'm in a venue where I'm really going to have so much less control over eliminating bias, you damn sure better cover that. And you better think about, what is this person that I don't want on my jury? What's likely to be the thing that would make them think, but this is that one good lawsuit? And what's the thing that's most likely going to make them say, this is bullshit? And make sure you don't leave the bullshit out there. And if you got to drop stuff, drop it. You got a life care plan and maybe they're stretching it a little. And you got this jury that you're worried about. Take the fat out. This last trial we just hit on down in Tampa with a very fair and good verdict, we dropped $300,000 out of our life care plan the night before the guy testified. I never tell him what the life care plan is in open because it's stuff like that always happens to me. And it was, this lady was scaring me. And I thought, and we got this retired detective. And I thought, I can't risk those numbers that can be validated. They weren't BS numbers. In the wrong hands, they could look like BS. I knew what I would do on cross, and I knew they were going to score some points on it, but it wasn't something like, pull that out, that's not even fair. It was truly, it's fair, but it can be made to look unfair. We pulled it, because I always say, do you care how we get to a fair number, which category it's on? Because this is supposed to be an asset, having a life care plan. If part of it turns into liability, it's going to sound good when you put the big number up, and you're going to get a zero, and nothing's going to feel good after the verdict. Drop it. So we did. He still put up some numbers, but they were scale way down. And you know what? We got a good verdict. Those are just some of the things. If I do that in every case. It just seemed it becomes such life and death where you have less control over jury selection.
I'm curious about how Morgan & Morgan structures its practice, which sounds like you come into cases that are right sort of toward the tail end and help prepare and try the cases. Are you trying the case from kind of beginning to end, or are you partnering with the lawyer who's worked it up and discovered it? And are you involved in the discovery phase too to kind of work it through? Or
first of all, yes, I partner up. We split the case, and I'll tell you how we usually do it. I used to be the only what we would call a trial specialist. We've now got some other folks there. Keith Carter was the first, second one to do it down in Tampa, and then we've added multiple others. I'm going to leave names out, but you know, Rick Block and Brian McLean, who are just fantastic lawyers. I'd have either one of them represent my family. So I'm now not the only one doing it, but we all come in it late. We let the lawyers that are work it up. We learn them, study them in that last week or whatever it is. We learn a massive amount of information in a short period of time, but you have that resource that's been there for the whole time with you, and we split up the trial. I typically do jury selection, opening and closing, and the main cross-examinations, they usually put on our witnesses. However, if it's like 2 days go by, I haven't done anything, I may say I'll do this witness on direct. Or if it's someone older and I'm older and it's our client, maybe it feels a little more natural if I do them. But we split it up and down, and all the decisions are split up and down, and it's really a joint effort. I don't come in and hog it all. Wouldn't be fair to the other lawyers, nor would it be as, we wouldn't be as effective. They know some of the nuances work better if they do that, put on that part of the case. People get sick of you. Whether you're likable or not with the jury, by the time we get off here, y'all going to say, I like the guy, but God Almighty talks a lot. You get sick of people, juries get sick of you. You got to have a break. So it's good to be flipping people in and out.
What's the process from when the case gets assigned to you to work with the team to get it ready for trial? Do you have a kind of a process for that?
Yeah, it depends on the case. Like a med mal, I need more time to get ready. A car crash, you know, if we do so, everything. Product case, I want more time. These, we call them BTG, business trial group, where we're these business disputes where we come in on a contingency fee on those. Those are complicated and everyone's reinventing the wheel. So you need more time to get ready for them. But your typical car crash, you know, the system is, you know, it's going about a week out and I get it all put in a Dropbox and I use transcript pad to index depositions, and I just start reading and I start firing off emails or making phone calls, and I drive the other lawyers crazy with questions. It never fails. Did you do this or this? And there's a no. And people will say, I love working with Mitnick, but it's stressful. I'm not mean about it. I'm a perfectionist about trial. And so I'm going to ask, if it's not done, I don't go, oh, well, you idiot. I go, all right, never mind. Let's move on to something else. But they know by the all right, you're disappointed, because you are. But that's part of the learning too. But in any event, so I come in and I just ask lots of questions. The benefit of coming in late is this, because I've worked plenty of cases up. You know, I've been doing this coming up on 40 years. So, I mean, I did pay my dues working the case up from meeting the client, filing the papers and interrogatories and everything else to the end. I'm blessed. I don't have to do it now. I do get to do the fun part. But here's the advantage coming in late. The disadvantage, you can be frustrated if things aren't done quite the way I would have done them. And our firm's gotten very good about doing them right, but there are different ways of right. We all have our ways we'd like to do it. But the flip side that I would trade it all day long is this. When you ride a case from beginning to trial, you get in your mind baked in what the case is about. You've just been on that roller coaster and it's been formulating, and now your brain's glued in, this is the case. The defense is glued in, this is the case. I come in and see it like a jury. I get it all fresh in one big way, just like the jury. It's overwhelming, trying to keep track of when did this happen, who's this, just like they do. So I see it through their eyes better than some. I could not see it through their eyes as well if I'd worked it all the way up. I just can't divorce myself from that experience. I have no one to divorce. I'm coming into it really fresh. And typically, the defense, you can see them looking over like, well, that isn't it. When opening statement, they're going, you can see them like, that's not the case I expected it to be. And I think that's an advantage because they're not real good at adjusting on the fly. And so the process is you get in late, learn fast, ask lots of questions, and then present it in a way that is most likely to win and most likely to make sense to a jury who's going to be overwhelmed with information overload.
When do you decide that you're actually going to get involved in a case? You're going to get all the information a week or so before trial on a car crash case, but was there a decision before that that Keith is trying this case?
It's one of the difficult parts of my weird workup system. Any week, I will have four or five trials on that week. Someone will email my assistant and say, I want to get an appointment to do so-and-so. And the answer is, well, he's got some. I tell them, email me, because they're not all going to happen, obviously, but they're always there. So my system is, as I start getting closer, depending on, look, they're big cases. We sue tobacco companies. And if we got one of those, I know that one's, you know, 6 months out. And I'm working on that on and off for months. And I know exactly when that is. But if it's your typical week, I'll call my secretary when I get out of a trial, what's my next trial? She'll say, well, you got next week or 2 weeks from now, you got these three or four. I start figuring out where am I best suited to go. Typically, I'll go on the what I feel is a better case, but sometimes it's a case that needs more help and it isn't. So in any event, there's a decision-making process, which case you're going on. And it never fails. There's a case, two of them I really, really, really want to try, and I've committed to them, and they fall at the same time. And I'm like, why in the hell can't? Then I got 2 weeks with no trial. I'm like, why do these have to fall at the same time? I try to carve out time to do some cases outside of my firm. It's fun for me. I meet new people. You make new friends. I like sharing these systems that work, and I know there's no better way to share them than to get in a foxhole together. So I try to make room for two, three, maybe four a year outside of the firm. And it never fails. There will be a big one in my firm that's my obligation for. At a time, I wanted to help someone with another case, and I got to call them. And I always tell them, I'm coming unless. And then it gets closer, and they get nervous. And then I end up saying, I can't do this one then, or we have to move it. And I've done that before, and then they've made other arrangements, and then my case didn't go. So there's this craziness of fixing them in. But I also do some out. I get on one with somebody outside, and I say, I tell my assistant, put a fence around it. Anybody from our firm got a case falling in that, tell them no, they're going to have to move it if they want me to go. So that's the stress. Working the schedule is a mess. But I wouldn't trade it. I'm not asking for sympathy. I love being able to try all these cases. People ask me sometimes, how can you be in trial that often? I say, first of all, if you didn't have to do all the hard stuff, and like, for example, having the jury instructions ready, you could do it too. This is easier, not harder, even though it's very stressful and you're living out of hotels and things. So, but the other thing is this, that I really believe in my two things that I believe in my heart of hearts. I'm an average person. I don't, you know, I'm a nice guy, but I'm not great at a lot of other things. And, you know, I'm not a golfer. I was a good athlete in high school, but I'm a spastic golfer. I gave it up. And they're just, I don't have all these other things. And I walk around feeling very average most of the time. I walk in a courtroom and you feel special. And it's like, why you want to go there often? I feel better about myself. I'm over there doing something I'm actually good at. And the other thing is, it's like hallowed ground to me. And the way our politics are now, in our country, the division in our country just breaks my heart. You know, everybody hates each other and both sides are worried the world's coming to an end. And I'll keep my politics to myself. But I hate what I see in our country. The division and the dislike of one another. You walk in a courtroom and it's all American justice. People, they may not even want to be there, but after they're there a day or two, it sinks in their pores and we're all proud to be there. We're all working together for a common goal and all this other stuff on the outside doesn't exist. And it's in a room where the truth actually still matters. And I worry in the world, does the truth matter anymore? It matters in a courtroom. And it's like, going on a vacation from all this crap going on in our country. And so going there is healing to me. I tell the juries that sometimes. I tell them, you know, look, I did it one time in a case where I had a bunch of Republicans on my jury And it's a venue that is known for terrible plaintiffs' jurors, very, very conservative. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to talk to him about it. And I, not politics, but I like that. I told him, I said, you know, folks, we have differences in our country of so much. It makes us, I know we're all sad about it. We're mad about it maybe, but we're sad about it too. I said, but you know what? You guys are getting to spend a place that I've spent so much of my life here. I'm one of the most lucky people in the world because this is hallowed ground. This is where we get to come together. This is where we get to do something unified, all American justice. And you can see people sitting up, you know, and they it touches them. I usually start tearing up when I say it because I mean it. We are fortunate to be in a field where we can escape some of that and we can have a fair fight, usually, unless we got a judge putting his hand on the scale. But
you've tried so many cases over your career. Are there moments or particular cases that stand out to you as even more kind of memorable than everything else?
My first big tobacco verdict, and it was big, it was $90 million. I'm proud of that. You can tell I worked it in somehow. But that's not what really made it so important to me. When you get into the documents and things and see what they did, this is back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and the 70s, and you see the story and the documents and the weight of the world on your shoulders of that verdict, because it's more than just your client. You feel like I'm taking on somebody that is the poster child for what I went to law school to fight. This is it. This is the one. This isn't just an individual case. Maybe I can make a difference in changing behavior with these people, at least make a statement of how this is totally unacceptable in our society. And that first verdict, I felt good. I talked to my wife the night before and started choking up and had to get off the phone because I couldn't talk. And she said, are you all right? I said, I'll call you back. And I called her back and she says, what's the matter? I said, I can't lose this case. I said, the weight of this thing feels so immense. And, you know, they're hard cases. And, we won it. And that feeling will never leave me. And I won some more. I started feeling I never lose to him. And I lost one to him. And it was one of the most memorable bad experiences of my life. Because I do, to this day, I feel like I failed on something that really mattered. It's like a black mark in my life. But in any event, they were one. And on a simpler, not simpler note, but not this big global take on the world, I recently had a really good verdict with a lady that got under my skin so much. I sound like a big crybaby, but I guess I am. After the verdict came in, I went to hug her, and I had to leave, go down to the other end of the hall because I started to sob. Because this lady, she had had spinal bifida at birth, which means she was in a wheelchair, crutches and stuff, couldn't walk right. They didn't think she was going to live. She went on to get her master's degree and be a special ed teacher, working with other special needs kids like she had been. And she had such a tough life, and she would never tell you she had a tough life. She had a great life if you talked to her. And she had gotten a big bed sore that took forever to heal. And then our case was it affected her ability to transfer from bed to wheelchair and is creating all kind of nightmares for her. And to stand up for that lady who literally and figuratively couldn't stand up for herself, and she was such an amazing human being that... And the jury was out a long time, and it was a hard case. And I just had this feeling we were going to lose it. And it was going to be like tobacco all over. You know, I've let this lady down, who really, she's standing up and fighting. And I was so convinced personally we were so right. But, you know, defense was very good, and it makes it not so clear. When we won that case, the relief to not have to carry the load of losing it. It wasn't so much a celebration. It was that, hallelujah, I did not lose this case. And I looked at that lady and I looked in her eyes, and her peace wasn't like big triumph. It was this peace. Oh my God, I had to get away for a minute and then come back. And I said, I'm sorry. But you're just overwhelmed by the weight of it all and the emotion of it. Those are two of the most memorable. I could go on and on and on. I got a bunch of memorable ones. I'll give you one last one. It was very little money involved. It was a first party case. We're suing an insurance company because this guy's bought a truck, couldn't afford it. Guy had came in on asylum from Cuba and was an American citizen. He's like, I don't know, 22 years old, young guy, great guy. And he learned to make furniture with his granddad had taught him. And the guy was a real craftsman. He made this beautiful handmade furniture. Well, his truck he bought, he was some big fancy truck he couldn't afford, and he was behind in his payments. His wife had gotten pregnant, and he had left his job, and his truck burns. So you can imagine what the damned insurance company figured. He burned his own truck. And what happened is there was a gang that was stealing trucks and would use them in robberies and then take them out someplace and burn them. And this was out in the same area burned. That's what happened. But they fought the hell out of it. You know, they had locksmiths. They had everything you'd imagine. Their whole case was he's a fraud. He did it himself. You were broke. And my framing around that was this was in the middle of when we had that big damn near the financial depression back, I don't know how many years ago when we, the big, you know, everything was really rough. And my whole thing is we had a bunch of people I knew from jury selection who were struggling financially too. And I said, the gall of this insurance company, they say, if you're on tough financial times, that makes you a felon, makes you a criminal. And you could see people, yeah, yeah, bullshit to that. So that's how we framed around it. I said, all he had to do was let him come repossess his truck. He doesn't have to become a felon and leave the country he just got here from. But why it touched me so much is this kid told me right after, and we won the case and, you know, got his truck paid for it. And then we got a bunch of fees for fighting it. But that guy came over to me about 6'2", hugs me, and he starts crying. And he says, you know, I came to this country because it was so different from Cuba. And at the center of it was just this feeling where anybody can get justice. And if they'd have found against me, I would have felt like I was branded a criminal and like I'd no one wanted me and didn't belong. And he goes, this is reminded me I made the right decision to come to this country. I love this country. And the guy says, and I love you for helping me see it. So not a big brag on verdict, but man, that one touched me. And then just to end the story even happier, like several months later, a truck pulls up to my house and this beautiful rocking chair and wooden table to go beside it for your drinks was delivered. And I still have my rocking chair from that guy.
Wow. That's fantastic. Those are some great, great results, great cases. Appreciate you sharing all that with all of us. Boy, this hour is just flowing by, Rahul. We could go on and on, but we really appreciate your time, Keith.
Oh, I appreciate you guys going, you know, I can tell your hearts are in the same place. I can see your expressions. And I always say real trial lawyers and people with a real heart know one another. You can smell it. You can see it. They don't even have to say anything. And this is a pleasure. You're my kind of guy. So if you ever want to do it again sometime, I'm in.
Oh, we'd love it, Keith. Appreciate it. And then we'll see you in about a month.
I'm going to add one last thing just to folks. Just, I said something earlier about my at home but not alone written brushstrokes. If anybody wants to get on my listserv, it doesn't cost anything. During COVID, when we were shut down, I was doing every week. I'm now doing them, you know, depends when I'm out of trial and I have time, but at least once a month. I think I'm up to 52 of them. And they're just written 1 to 3 page summaries of a new strategy or something that I think that may be helpful. And I'll be doing them for a long time. I love doing them. If you want to get those, if you simply email me at kmitnick, it's K-M-I-T-N-I-K, not people will put an N-I-C-K like the name Nick. I won't get it. It's no C. K-M-I-T-N-I-K at forthepeople.com, forthepeople.com. And just say, yeah, I heard you and I'd like to be on your list, sir. And if you'll do one more thing, add on that my assistant, Mary Arnold, and it's marnold@forthepeople.com. It just gets to her quicker. And she will not only add you for the future ones, she'll send you the batch of all the ones done up to that time. And I don't get anything out of it other than deeply believe in a rising tide lifts all boats. And I'm in a unique position to try lots of cases. So I end up with a bunch of strategies and I try to pass them around as much as I can to others that are fighting against injustice. So
Panish circulates your brushstrokes to all the lawyers at our firm every time you send them out, and we all love them. So thank you for doing that. And for anybody who hasn't seen them, get them.
Yeah, I can't wait to get out there. So you're going to be there, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to seeing you. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm not sure what night I'm coming out, but let's plan some dinner.
That'd be great. Ben and me will both be there. We're looking forward to dinner with you.
Great meeting you, Keith.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.